energetic humping because Tracy couldn't have an orgasm to save her life and was always getting so close, but never quite there. So keep going. Harder, faster, harder, faster. Oh, baby, baby, baby. And when he came inside her, she seemed to like it, and she held him close as if they were a couple again, even though they had never really been a couple. Once the sexual preliminaries were out of the way, it was his turn to really get off. They were out on his terrace overlooking the city, and Tracy had her head on his shoulder. Very romantic and cute, in a pathetic sort of way. Like going on a date with Meg Ryan, or Daryl Hannah, maybe. I'm going to tell you a little about what I've been up to, he finally said. Until then, everything had been about her. I want to hear all about it, sweetie. Only I can't leave the kid too late back in my hotel. The nanny threatens to quit. Now that he remembered, Tracy was kind of a selfish bitch most of the time. Does anybody know about the two of us tonight? He asked. No, duh. So what are you up to? Something big, of course. You're due. Yeah, it's kind of a mystery thing. It's big, all right. Really different, though. Nothing anything like it before. I'm writing the story myself. The story of stories. Wow, that's great. You're writing it yourself, huh? Yeah. You know those murders in L.A.? Mary Smith? She knew a little, but not everything, since she'd been up in Vancouver for 4 weeks, so we quickly filled her in. You bought the rights? Wow, that's great. And what, you want me to produce? He shook his head in disbelief. From who, Tracy? Who would I buy the rights from? Oh, right. Well, so what's the deal then? So I can talk to you? Really talk? Of course you can talk to me. Tell me your big idea, your story. I love thrillers. This is it. Go or no go. What's it going to be? I planned those murders, Tracy. I'm Mary. Wow. It was out. Just like that. I'm Mary. Holy shit. She looked at him real funny. Funny peculiar. And suddenly he knew this had been a very bad idea. And old Tracy wasn't the crazy one. He was. He'd just blown his whole deal. And for what? To let off a little steam with an old girlfriend? To vent? Confess? She was staring at him as if he had two heads, at least that many. Come again? What are you saying? He laughed. Faked it the best he could, anyway. It's a joke, Trace. We're high, I made a joke. Hey, let me give you a ride home. You've got the kid at your hotel, the nanny and whatever. I hear you. And you're a good mommy, right?
Chapter 57.
They didn't talk much in the car, so we knew how big a mistake he'd made. And now he wondered if he'd made other mistakes along the way. Maybe important ones that would get him caught. Like way back in New York City, the movie theater shootings. I've been under a lot of stress lately, you know? He finally spoke. She muttered, Sure, I hear you. Man, she was making him paranoid. And a little nuts, actually. They've been friends for a long time, though. So how old is the kid now? 4 and a half. He's great. Stefan. She was really scaring him. Now what? What the hell should he do? This wasn't a Mary Smith scene. Tracy wasn't even in his story. This was bad news. Suddenly he pulled his rented Volvo over to the side of the road. Now what? What's the matter? She asked. What? You better get out right here, Trace. I'm not kidding you. Get out. Walk the rest of the way. Walk? Are you crazy? What are you talking about? Get out of the car right now. Get out before I throw you out. I got her moving. She threw open the passenger's door and stumbled outside, cursing him like a truck driver. It was cold out there, and she had both arms wrapped around her. Then she started to cry. You're crazy. You know that? I thought we were friends. She started to run away on the dark residential side street somewhere between the Marriott and her hotel. The storyteller got out of the car and found himself following close behind. Tracy, wait! Hey, Tracy! He caught up to her easily. Hey! I'm sorry for scaring you, baby. I'm really sorry. Hey, you okay? And then he shot her in the throat. And when she was down on the sidewalk, he shot her again in the head. And this time it wasn't good. It didn't feel good at all. This time it felt kind of bad. Scared the hell out of him. Because the story was taking over. The story was writing itself. And the story didn't seem to care who got hurt.
Chapter 58. As I flew from Seattle back to Los Angeles the next day, it struck me again how darkly appropriate the Mary Smith case was as a backdrop to my entire life. I was also starting to feel like some kind of record setter for complicated or failed relationships. The only closure I had reached with Christine was that we would speak more soon. It excited me to think about having little Alex, Ali, closer by, but I wasn't about to get attached to the idea. Christine had proved herself too changeable in the past for me to trust that anything she said might happen for sure. As it turned out, I got sucked back into the murder case even before I made it through the terminal at LAX. A television news report caught my ear, and I stopped to watch the next development unfold. I couldn't look away as a talking head reported, "At a press conference this morning, lead detective on the Hollywood stalker case, Gene Galletta, denied the existence of any so-called kill list." Hollywood stalker was a media moniker that had emerged lately from Mary Smith. As for a kill list, I had no idea what the TV reporter was talking about. LAPD is urging area residents to remain calm and go about their business. Many people, however, aren't buying it. One citizens' group appeared at the local precinct demanding to see the kill list, which police claim doesn't even exist. Either way, and whoever you choose to believe, one thing is clear. The stalker has this community, she inserted a reporterly pause, very much on edge. Lorraine Soley, reporting live from Beverly Hills. Kill list? What the hell was this? Had the LAPD found out something and then not shared it with us? It wouldn't be the only time. The first person I was able to reach at the FBI field office was David Fujishiro, another special agent assigned to the murder case. "It's way, way out in left field," he told me. "There's this supposed list with 21 names, starting with Patrice Bennett, Antonia Schiffman, and Marty Lowenstein Bell. The idea is that it's Mary Smith's agenda." "And everyone in L.A. wants to know if they're on it?" I asked. "One of the 21? "Right. And it gets even better than that. The rumor is that anyone on the list can buy their way off by sending $100,000 to a post office box in Orange County that doesn't seem to exist. We've checked it all out, not that anyone believes us. People are actually threatening legal action against the LAPD.
"But there's no truth to the rumor, David?"
"You're sure?"
"Not that we know of.
But hey, what the hell do we know? We're only the FBI.
"This case is getting its own social life," I said. "Has anybody spoken to Detective Galletta about the list?"
"I don't know, but..."
"What?"
There was a pause on the line.
"Hang on, Alex."
"David, what's happening?"
I could hear voices in the background, but nothing distinct. Agent Fujishiro came back on and told me to wait another second.
"Something's up," he added.
"Wait," I yelled. But it was no good. He was gone again. More voices came, then a general rumbling, rising in pitch. What the hell was happening? Then I heard Fujishiro saying,
"Yeah, I've got him right here on the phone.
Alex, Fred Van Allsburg needs to talk to you right now. Hold the line." I was never glad to hear from Van Allsburg, but his voice had a no-bullshit tension to it.
"What's going on?" I said.
"That's what we're trying to figure out right now. All we know at the moment is that Arnold Greiner at the Times just got another email. Can you get over to the LA Times office right away?"
"Not if there's a new murder scene, I can't. I need to see it now."
"I'm not going to negotiate this, Alex. We'll get word to you as soon as we know what's what. Meanwhile..." I couldn't help myself. I cut him off. Sir? Hello? Can you hear me? I hung up in the middle of Van Allsburg shouting that he could hear me fine. Then I called Agent Page and told him to put me on hold until we knew if Mary Smith had a new victim. Chapter 59. Susie Cartoulis wasn't paying much attention to the real world as she backed out of the driveway that morning. Her thoughts were on an unfinished pool cabana in the backyard of the house in Pacific Palisades, and the blankety-blank contractor who wasn't returning any of her phone calls, who never returned her calls, only her husband's. 2 more days like this, and she was going to fire the guy's ass. Right after she set it on fire. Another car, idling just past a neighbor's cedar hedge, came into sight at the last second. Susie braked hard to avoid hitting the jerk who was parked there. Her heart thudded. That certainly would have been an auspicious way to start her day, a fender bender 10 feet from her driveway. She gave a quick wave into the rearview mirror. Sorry. My bad. Then she put her silver Mercedes wagon in drive and started down the cul-de-sac toward Sunset. The other car pulled out as well and began to follow, but Susie Cartoulis didn't notice. Her focus had shifted to the 9-year-old boy in the back seat. Are you all right, Zach? I didn't mean to stop so suddenly like that. I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. All right. Just checking, sweetie. How about a little music? What do you want to hear? She tried not to be overbearing, but it was hard sometimes. Zachary was such a sensitive boy, and he didn't react well to being ignored either. Maybe if he had a little brother or sister, but that wasn't going to happen anytime soon. Not now that Susie had become the 10 o'clock anchor. She had finally gotten into the inner sanctum of recognizable faces in L.A. No small feat for a former weather girl from Tucson, thank you very much. And she wasn't going to let another pregnancy slow her down right now. Especially since New York was apparently very interested in her as well. As if on cue, the phone rang. Caller ID showed her husband's cell number, and she juggled the headset up to her ear. Hi, where are you, honey? She spoke through a frown she was glad Gio wasn't there to see. Miami, I think we're wrapping up. I have to shoot up to Palm Beach in a minute. Of course, there's another hurricane on the horizon, so I want to vamoose out of here. We just need a few signatures, but it looks like the contract's a go. Great, she said with hollow enthusiasm. She was supposed to know what project he was talking about, but they all blended together. Something about a shopping mall in southern Florida. Was that right? Was Vero Beach in South Florida? The Treasure Coast? This was their game. He spoke about his work as if she cared, and she pretended to. So I should be home tonight instead of Monday, which would be nice. Maybe play a little golf this week? Wyatt finally invited me to Riviera. Mm-hmm. How's the little dude? He's right here. Hang on. Susie surrendered the phone to the back seat. It's Daddy. Be nice. She was already rearranging today's schedule in her head. Get someone else to cover the mayor's press conference on the ongoing murders. Have the housekeeper pick up Zach after tennis practice. Call Brian, see if he can get away, then call the Ramada and ask for an early check-in. Get laid properly once more before her all-business, all-the-time husband got back to town. Make it an afternoon to remember. Chapter 60.
To A. Greiner at LATimes.com, from Mary Smith. To Susie Cartoulis. People in Los Angeles watch you on television every day, reporting the news, acting like you really know what's going on. That's what you do so well. Acting, pretending, faking it with flair. But today will be a little different, Suze. Today you will be the news. They'll say that Susie Cartoulis and her handsome former beach volleyball champ lover were found slain in a hotel room. That's how you people talk, isn't it? Slain. But no matter what they say on the news, no one will ever know just how you looked at me when I killed you. The incredible fear, the confusion, and what I took to be respect. It was different this morning outside your fancy house in Pacific Palisades. You almost bumped into me with your highly polished silver Merc wagon, and you looked right through me. You did, Zeus. Trust me on that. I remember these kinds of things. Then, just like the others, you went on with your day like I wasn't even there. I had a feeling today might be the last one for you. Then I was sure of it. First, I watched you say goodbye to your darling little boy for the last time. He probably can't appreciate everything you do for him, all the sacrifices, but he'll think about it later, when someone else has to take him to school or to practice the next time he goes. You're right about one thing, though. You should have made more time in your life for Zachary. Coulda, shoulda. Then I followed you to the hotel in West Hollywood. At first, I didn't know why you went there, but I figured it out pretty quickly that you weren't going to die alone. That delicious-looking blonde man you met. You two were perfect for each other. Central casting all the way. I could tell just by looking that he's the kind of somebody you are. Am I right? He went to the Olympics, after all. He's an exec at your network. Another fast tracker. And now you have another thing in common. You're both dead somebodies. Killed by a nobody you couldn't even see when you looked right at her. I gave you two some quality time before I came up there for you. Enough time to feel safe in your little cocoon of deceit. Maybe even enough to do what you had in mind for your sneaky little rendezvous. Then, when I came in, I saw him first. That was a bit of good luck. Know why? I wanted you to see him die. It put the fear of God on your face before I shot you. And then I got to cut that fear away, one piece at a time, till you weren't afraid anymore. You weren't anything anymore. You were nothing, Susie Cartoulis. Just like me.
Chapter 61. I was still on the road when word came about Mary Smith's latest. A triple homicide this time. The killer's deadliest strike to date, at least as far as we knew for certain. I was still chasing down leads on the triple homicide in New York, but progress was slow, and suddenly I was off to another crime scene. Susan Cartoulis, a prize-winning newscaster, had been found dead, along with her lover, in a room at the Ramada Plaza Suites in West Hollywood. The dead man was Brian Conver, a sports producer at the same network where Ms. Cartoulis worked. A second woman, Mariah Alexander, a college student who attended Southern Cal, had also been killed. What was that all about? I asked Agent Page to read Mary Smith's latest email message over the phone while I drove. The text made clear that the newswoman had been the primary target. Mr. Conver was never mentioned by name, and there was no reference whatsoever to any Mariah Alexander. What do we know about Susan Cartoulis? I asked Page. Does she fit the M.O.? Basically, yeah. She fits right into the puzzle. Married with one son, good-looking woman, high profile in the city. She was a 10 o'clock anchor for a local affiliate, also the honorary chair of the Cedars-Sinai Pediatric Burn Unit Capital Campaign. 9-year-old son. Another perfect mom. With a boyfriend on the side. Well, I guess nobody's perfect. Is that what Mary's trying to tell us? Maybe, I said. The press was going to eat up this one, as if they weren't already overfed. It made me feel even sorrier for Susan Cartoulis' husband and her young son. Her murder and infidelity would be trotted out for the public in great detail. Do you think that has anything to do with it? Page asked. Perfect mothers who aren't so perfect after all? Hypocrisy on the home front? Something as simple as that? If that's Mary Smith's point, I said, she's being pretty murky about it, especially for someone who's so deliberate in getting her message out there in her emails. Plus, as far as we know,
most of the murdered women actually live up to their reputations.
As far as we know, said Paige.
Stay tuned on that one, yeah?
All right, why don't you do a little digging around about the others? See if you can find any dirty little secrets we missed.
Try Arnold Greiner. I'll bet he has an inside line or two.
That's his job, right?
The forensics of gossip, huh? Paige said, and laughed.
I'll see what I can do. See if I can get Greiner to talk about anything besides himself.
Who was the other victim?
Mariah Alexander.
Yeah, that really sucks. She was a maid at the hotel, college kid.
We think Mary got in the room with her passkey.
One other thing, I said. If anyone asks, you haven't heard from me and you don't know where I am.
Paige paused on the line.
I'm not gonna lie if someone asks me, but I won't volunteer anything. Anyway, I'm on my way out of the office.
Good enough.
By the way, you're doing a terrific job.
For a surfer boy, huh?
Exactly, dude.
Chapter 62. I followed Carl Page's directions toward the Ramada Plaza in West Hollywood and deliberately left my phone in the car when I got there. I didn't want to be reached by anybody at the bureau right now, not even Director Burns's office. The stark Art Deco lobby was quiet and depressing. Dreary, dried-up palms loomed over rows of boxy, chocolate-brown couches, all of them empty. Two elderly women at the front desk were the only customers in sight. Whoever was in charge here, Jean Galetta, I hoped, had gotten a good cap on the scene. The only indication that a major investigation was underway one story up was the two officers stationed at the elevator. I took the stairs to the murder scene, two at a time. The second-floor hallway was thick with LAPD personnel. Several of them wore gloves, white booties, and crime scene unit polo shirts. The faces were all stressed and drawn. A uniformed officer gave me the once-over. "Who are you?" he asked. His tag said Sandhausen. I flashed him my creds without comment and kept moving past him. "Hey!" he called out. "Hey yourself!" I called back and kept going. When I got to room 223, the door was wide open. A row of cartoonish stickers, Mary Smith's calling card, was affixed to the outside. Two glittery winged fairies and another unicorn, which was stuck right over the peephole. Two stickers were marked with an A, the other with a B. A maid's cart stood parked off to the side. "Is Jean Galetta around?" I asked another young officer as she pushed past me into the hall. The sheer number of people coming and going here was disconcerting. The female officer gave me a petulant look. "I think she's downstairs in the office. I don't know."
"Find out," I said, suddenly losing my patience. "Let her know Alex Cross is looking for her. I'll be in here."
I steeled myself before I stepped inside the hotel room. There's a necessary detachment at any murder scene, and I can feel it like a second skin that I put on. But there's a necessary balance, too. I never wanted to forget that this was about human beings, not just bodies, not just Vicks. If I ever got immune to that, I'd know it was time to look for another career. Maybe it was time anyway. What I found was a scene just as predictably brutal as I had come to expect from Mary Smith, plus a couple of nasty surprises that I wasn't prepared for. Chapter 63. The bathroom was a horror. Mariah Alexander, the 19-year-old hotel maid, lay collapsed backward in the tub, her head at a nearly impossible angle to her torso. Her throat was torn open where a bullet had erased any possibility of a scream. Her long, curly black hair was streaked with her blood. It looked as though the girl's carotid artery had been nicked, which would explain the blood spurts that extended all the way up the wall. A heavy set of keys lay on the tile floor near the dead girl's dangling feet.
My first guess was that Mary Smith had pulled a gun on the young woman, forced her to unlock the hotel room door, then backed her up into the bathroom and shot her, all in quick succession. Susan Cartulis and Mr. Conver would likely have been in the bedroom at that point, just a short hallway away. Someone, probably Conver, had come to see what was going on. If the bloodstains on the carpet were any indication, Mary Smith had intercepted Conver halfway between the bedroom and bathroom. His body, however, was now arranged on the bed next to Susan Cartulis. The lovers lay face up, side by side, on top of the covers. Both of them were nude, another first for Mary Smith, although it was likely they were undressed when she got there. Pillowcases were draped across the two victims' hips and over Ms. Cartulis's chest in an odd suggestion of modesty. Man, this was a wacky and confusing killer. The inconsistencies boggled the mind, mine anyway. It got even stranger. The king-size bed was perfectly made. It was possible that Cartulis and Conver hadn't used the bed while having sex, but soft drinks and a condom wrapper on the nightstand indicated otherwise. Did Mary Smith actually make the bed after she murdered three people? If so, she was good at it. Nana had long ago made sure I knew the difference between a real hospital corner and a lazy one. Mary Smith knew the difference as well. The tidily arranged covers were soaked with blood, particularly around Ms. Cartulis. Both victims had sustained gunshot wounds to the head, but Cartulis's face had also been brutalized with a blade, in Mary Smith's usual manner, and as promised in the email. I could just about make out Conver's last, strained expression of terror, but Cartulis's face had so many cuts it looked like a single open wound. It reminded me of the murders at Antonia Schiffman's house, neat and sloppy at the same time. One killer, two completely different impulses. What the hell had she been thinking? What did she want out of this? The most disturbing new wrinkle came a few minutes later. A yellow leather coach wallet with Susan Cartulis's driver's license and credit cards lay open on a chair near the bed. As I looked through the wallet, I saw that it was neatly filled with one thing and another, but that there were several empty plastic sleeves. The empty spaces sent tension up and down my spine. God damn it, I said out loud. Photographs. One of the crime scene unit staff turned to me. What's up? You find something? Do we know where Susan Cartulis's husband is? I asked. He's supposed to be on a plane, coming home from Florida. Why? I need to know if this woman carried family photos in her wallet. My question was a formality. I was almost certain I knew the answer. This would be the second time in as many incidents that Mary Smith had been interested in family photos. She'd gone from leaving the children entirely alone to either destroying or stealing their photographs. Meanwhile, her methodology was increasingly erratic, and her emails seemed more confident than ever. How slippery a slope was this going to be from here on? And where was it taking me? I didn't think I could live with myself if Mary Smith started turning on kids before we caught up to her. But that's what I was afraid might happen next. Chapter 64. Can I see you for a minute, Dr. Cross? We need to talk. I looked up to see Detective Jean Galetta standing in the door. Her expression was strained. I thought that she looked older than the last time we met, and thinner, as if she'd lost 10 pounds she hadn't needed to shed. We went out into the hall. What's going on? Don't tell me something else has happened. I don't want to go wide with this yet, she said in a low, tired voice. But there's a woman who saw a blue Suburban leaving the hotel parking lot in a big hurry. Happened around 2 o'clock. She didn't notice much else. I wonder if you could interview her, and then we could compare notes, before I do anything with this. It was a good move on her part. I'm pretty sure she was thinking the same thing I was. The D.C. sniper case in 2002 had included a massive public search for what turned out to be the wrong vehicle, a white van with black lettering. It was an investigative and public relations nightmare, exactly the kind of mistake LAPD wouldn't want to make now.
And could you do it right now?
That would be helpful. I'd appreciate it, she added.
If I'm going to run with this, I don't want to wait.
I hated to leave the crime scene. There was a lot of work to be done. If Jean weren't wearing her stress so plainly, maybe I would have said no. Give me 5 minutes to finish up here, I told her. I'll be right down. Meanwhile, I asked Jean to do me a favor and follow up with Giovanni Cartulis about the missing photos in his wife's wallet. There was frustratingly little we could do with the information from him, but it was important to know if Mary Smith had stolen family pictures. Also, Giovanni Cartulis needed to be eliminated as a suspect, as all the previous husbands had been. Jean and her people had been handling this, but I was satisfied with the reports. The LAPD was doing a good job.
What?
Jean asked, standing very still in the hallway and staring at me.
What are you thinking? Tell me, I can handle it.
I think. Take a deep breath. Don't give in to this crap. You're running the case as well as anyone possibly could, but you look like hell right now. She knitted her eyebrows.
Thanks?
You look good, just not as good as usual. You're pale, Jean. It's the stress. Nobody understands that until they get hit with it. Jean finally smiled. I look like a fucking raccoon. Big dark smears around my eyes. Sorry.
It's okay. I've got to run.
I thought about her earlier dinner invitation and my clumsy decline. If we had stood there a few seconds longer, maybe I would have reciprocated the invitation for later, but Jean, and the moment, were already gone. And I had an interview to do. A blue Suburban, right? Chapter 65. It wasn't the foot-long serpentine tattoos up and down both of Bettina Rogers' arms, or the half-dozen piercings on her face that made me doubt what she had just told me. Actually, Bettina was as good a witness as you get. It was more the fact that eyewitness accounts are notoriously sketchy and unreliable. FBI research has shown them to hover around 50% accuracy, even just a few minutes after an incident, and this was at least 2 hours later. That said, Bettina's confidence in what she had seen was unwavering. I was in the parking lot starting my car, she told me for the third time, and the Suburban tore out behind me over that way towards Santa Monica Boulevard. I turned around to look because it was going so fast. I know for sure it was dark blue, and I know it was a Suburban because my mom used to have one. I've ridden in it a million times. I remember thinking it was kind of funny because it was like my mom was driving crazy like that. She paused. The Suburban took a sharp left out of the parking lot. That's all I know. Can I fucking go now? That was about as much as Jean Galletta had gotten out of her, but I pressed on with a few more questions of my own. Any markings on the car? I asked. Bumper stickers, dents, anything at all? She shrugged. I mostly just saw it from the side, and like I said, it flew by super fast. For a Suburban. I didn't see the license plate or anything. How about the driver? Anything you noticed? Was there anyone else in the car? More than one person? She fiddled absently with one of the thick silver rings in her eyebrow while she thought about that. Her makeup was heavy and mostly black, except for the pale white cast of her face powder. I didn't know too much about Bettina, but she put me in mind of the urban vampire culture I'd investigated a few years back on a case. One thing I'd learned then was how sharp some of these people were, despite the goth slacker stereotype. Finally, Bettina shook her head. I want to say it was a woman, because that would make sense, right? I mean, Jesus shit, we're talking about that fucked up Hollywood stalker wench, aren't we? Don't bother to lie, I know it's her. One of the other cops told me already. I didn't respond, letting her think some more until she shrugged again. Blue Suburban going like a bat out of hell, left turn, that's all I really know for sure. That's my final answer. The fact that she wasn't inclined to fill in details actually boosted my confidence in her. It's incredible how many people do the opposite, sometimes just to please the interviewer. A few minutes later, I thanked Bettina for her time and help and let her go. Then I found Jean Galetta to tell her my thoughts. We met in an unused guest room on the second floor. Jean told me that another hotel patron had corroborated the story. Around 2 o'clock, he saw a large, dark blue SUV tearing out of the parking lot from his room on the third floor. He couldn't see too much, but he said it might have been a woman driver. That doesn't mean it was Mary Smith, I said. But if it was, this would be huge for us. At least 2 people saw the same vehicle leaving in a hurry. Jean nodded silently, weighing the idea. So then the $64,000 question remains. How big do we go with this? There were risks either way, and I puzzled it out loud, partly for her and partly for myself. Time's not on our side. Mary Smith hasn't shown any signs of slowing down. Just the opposite, in fact. She seems to be evolving. This is a chance to use the press to our advantage and speed up the search, if that's what you want. On the other hand, people are already scared and they're going to react to every blue Suburban they see, probably to every blue SUV. If this blows up in your face, then it's one more reason for the public not to trust the department. But if it gets you to Mary Smith, then everything's okay and you're a hero. Russian roulette, she said dryly. Name of the game, I said. By the way, I don't want to be a hero. Goes with the territory. She finally smiled. America's Sherlock Holmes. Didn't I read that somewhere about you? Don't believe everything you read. I could almost hear the clock ticking inside Jean's head, but maybe it was her heartbeat. All right, she said, looking at her watch. Let's do it up. I'm going to have to clear this with the department, but if I go now, we can get in a press conference before the early news. She paused at the door. Jesus, I hope this isn't a mistake I'm making. Just go, I said. Come with me, Alex. Okay? Okay, I said, in spite of the Sherlock Holmes remark. Chapter 66. This was big. No doubt about that, anyway. Even James Truscott was on hand. The news conference on the Blue Suburban got covered by everybody and their big brother, and was sure to be the lead item on every report until something else even more dramatic turned up on the L.A. murder case. Hopefully, it would be the capture of the Suburban and then Mary Smith, male or female. I didn't appear in the small group on camera with Detective Jean Galetta, but I met up with her minutes afterward. She was getting attagirls all around, but she broke away to come over and see me. Thanks for the help. The wise counsel, she said. So did I look like a fricking raccoon on national TV? No, you didn't. Well, yeah, you did. Then I smiled. I remember you saying one time, you have to eat, right? You still interested? Jean's worried look returned suddenly. Oh, Alex, not tonight. Then she winked and grinned. Gotcha. Yeah, we could eat, I guess. What are you in the mood for? Actually, I'm starving now. Italian sound good? Italian always sounds good to me. Jean's apartment was on the way to the restaurant, and she insisted we stop. I need to check out my face in my own mirror with lighting I trust and know, she explained. This'll only take 5 minutes, maybe even 7 minutes tops. Come up. I won't jump your bones, I promise. I laughed and followed her into a red brick building somewhere off of Santa Monica. Maybe I will jump your bones, she said as we walked up the stairs to her apartment. Which is exactly what happened as soon as she shut the door behind us. She spun around fast, grabbed me, kissed me, then let me go again. That was kind of nice. But I'm just messing with you, doctor. 10 minutes, just like I promised. 7. And then Jean scooted down the hall to her bedroom and the lighting she could trust. I'd never seen her so loose and lively. It was almost as if she was a different person away from the job. It took her a little more than 7 minutes, but the wait was worth it. The transformation kind of startling, actually. She'd always struck me as attractive, but she looked kind of tough at work, and definitely all business. Now she wore a silk t-shirt with jeans and sandals. Her hair was still wet from a quick shower, and Detective Jean Galetta seemed softer. Another side of her revealed.
I know. I look like hell, she said.
Only we both knew different.
She hit her forehead with the palm of her hand. I forgot to offer you a drink. Oh, God, what is it with me?
We only had 5 minutes, I said.
Right. Good point. You always, usually, say just the right thing. Okay, then. Let's go. The night awaits us.
The thing of it was, I could still feel the impression of Jean's body against mine, and her lips. Also, I was unattached now, wasn't I? Was I? To be honest, I was starting to get a little confused myself. But she was herding me out the door into the hallway, and then Jean whirled around on me again. This time I was ready for her and took her in my arms. We kissed, and it was longer and more satisfying than the first time. She smelled terrific, felt even better, and her brown eyes were beautiful up close like this. Jean took my hand, and she started to pull me back into her apartment. I stopped her.
You just got dressed to go out.
She shook her head.
No, I got dressed for you.
But then I gathered it together, got hold of my senses, and said, Let's go eat, Jean. She smiled and said,
Okay, let's eat, Alex.
Chapter 67.
At 4 o'clock in the morning, a 22-year-old actress named Alicia Pitt left Las Vegas and headed for L.A. The open casting call started at 9 o'clock, and she didn't want to be blonde chick number 305 in line. The part would already be gone before she even got to read. Her parents' Suburban, which the highly imaginative Pitts called Big Blue, was a gas guzzler without a conscience. Other than that, it was a free ride, so, all in all, the price was close to being right. Once Alicia got some kind of real work, maybe she could afford to actually live in L.A. Meanwhile, it was the endless back and forth for auditions and callbacks. Alicia ran her lines as she drove west on I-10, trying not to glance too much at the dog-eared script on the seat next to her. The familiar ritual continued almost all the way to L.A. Don't talk to me about pride. I've heard everything I need from you. You can't just... Wait, that wasn't it. She looked down at the script and then up again at the road and passing traffic. Don't talk to me about pride. I've heard it all before from you. There's nothing you can tell me now that I'll believe. You can just... Oh, shit. What are you doing, Alicia, you numbskull? Somehow, she had shuttled off the highway and then onto an exit ramp. It brought her down to a traffic light at an unfamiliar intersection. She was in L.A., but this definitely wasn't Wilshire Boulevard. It wasn't anywhere she'd ever been, from the look of it. Abandoned buildings mostly, and one burned-out car sitting on a far curb. A taxi, actually. Then she saw the men, boys, whatever they were, three of them, standing on the corner and staring her way. All right, she thought. Don't freak out, Alicia. Just get yourself turned around and back on the highway. You're right as rain. Everything is cool. She willed the red light in front of her to change as she craned her neck, looking for the ramp back onto the highway. One of the young guys had wandered out into the intersection now, his head tilted for a better view through her windshield. He wore baggy cargo pants and a sky blue sweat jacket. He couldn't have been more than 16, 17. Then the two others came along slowly behind. By the time Alicia thought to run the red light, the boys were standing in front of the hood of her car, blocking the way. Oh, great. Now what?
Chapter 68.
She squeezed her eyes shut for just half a second. What were you supposed to do in this situation? And why had she never gotten around to buying a cell phone? Maybe because she was almost dead broke. When she opened her eyes again, the one in the blue jacket was at her side window, a menacing look on his face, a tattoo of a red dragon on his neck. She screamed in spite of herself, just a small yelp, but enough for him to see how scared she was. Then her panic level crept even higher. It took her a moment to realize the kid in blue was saying something, his hands held up flat in a calm down sort of gesture. She cracked the window. What? She said, unable to keep her voice from quivering. I said, you lost? He asked. That's all, lady. You lost? You look lost. Alicia choked back a sob. Yes, I'm so sorry. It was a bad habit. She apologized for everything. I'm just looking for... 'Cause I know you don't live around here, he said. His expression shifted and hardened again. The others laughed at the joke. This your car? Fear and confusion locked Alicia into subservience, which she hated. All she could think to do was answer his question. It's my parents. The guy in blue rubbed his chin whiskers as if considering her answer. Lot of people looking for a car just like this one, he said. Don't you read the papers? Watch TV?
I'm just trying to get to Westwood for an audition, a TV movie. I got off the highway before I was supposed to.
He howled with laughter, turning away from the car to his group and then back again. His movements were casual and slow. She's trying to get to Westwood to be in a movie. A film. Damn, that's about exactly what I expected. 'Cause I know you ain't got no interest in anything or anybody round here. Nah, man, said one of the other boys. She'd do her killing in the rich neighborhoods. I got no problem with that, said another. Kill the rich, eat the rich, whatever.
What are you saying?
She looked at each of them now, desperate for any kind of clarity. A clue about what she should say or do to get out of there. Her wild-eyed gaze fell on the rearview mirror.
Could I back out of here? Fast? Really, really fast? Pedal to the metal kind of thing?
The kid at her window lifted his jacket to show a pistol tucked into the waistband of his jeans. You don't want to do that, he said. The idea that she could be murdered before she had her morning coffee came over Alicia with an ugly reckoning.
Please, I just... Please, don't hurt me, she stammered.
She could hear the helplessness in her own voice. It was like listening to someone else, someone pathetic. God, she was supposed to be an actress. The man in blue nodded slowly, in a way she couldn't decipher. Then he stepped back from the car and put his hand out to let her pass. Highway's that way, he said. The other two moved off to the side, too. Alicia felt as if she might faint from relief. She gave the man a watery smile.
Thank you. I'm so sorry, she said again.
Her hands were shaking on the steering wheel, but at least she was safe. The Suburban had barely inched forward when, with a sickening crack, the front windshield shattered into a spiderweb of about a million glass pieces. An instant later, a heavy metal pipe smashed through the driver's side window. Paralysis overtook Alicia. Her arms and legs wouldn't function. She couldn't even scream.
The impulse to floor the accelerator got to her brain a moment too late. About a second after, her car door flew open, and large, powerful hands dragged her out onto the street. Alicia landed on her back, the air rushing out of her lungs in a gasp. "What kind of stupid are you?" she heard someone say, and then she felt a shock of pain on the side of her head. Then she saw a pipe rise up high and come down really fast, a blur aimed right at the center of her forehead.
Chapter 69. Everything had changed suddenly and dramatically on Mary Smith. Jean Galetta was out. She was completely off the case. She'd been reassigned. I tried going to bat for her, but within hours of Alicia Pitt's murder, she was history on Mary Smith. That evening, Police Chief Shrewsbury announced that he would be personally overseeing the Hollywood stalker murders, and that Detective Galetta was on temporary leave pending an investigation into the unfortunate murder of a young Las Vegas woman driving a blue Suburban. Jean was inconsolable, but she was getting the full spectrum of experiences on the case, including a turn as sacrificial lamb. "The mayor of Las Vegas telling the mayor of L.A. to tell the chief of police how to run an investigation?" she ranted to me. "When did this stop being about professionals doing good work?" "Somewhere around the dawn of time," I said. The two of us met for a drink around 8 o'clock that night. She picked the spot and said she wanted to make sure I had everything I needed from her on the murder investigation. Of course, she also wanted to vent. "I know Alicia Pitt's my fault, but..." "Jean, stop right there. You aren't responsible for what happened to that woman. It might have come as a result of a decision you made, but that's not the same thing. You made the best call you could. The rest is politics. You shouldn't have been taken off the case either." She didn't speak for several seconds. "I don't know," she finally said. "That poor girl is dead." "Do you have any vacation time?" I asked her. "Maybe you should use it." "Yeah, like I'm going to leave town now," she said. "I may be off the case, but..." She didn't finish her sentence. But she didn't need to. I had been in her position before. It's best not to say out loud that you're going to break the rules. Just go ahead and break them. "Alex, I'm going to need my space," she said. "That's why I wanted to meet you here." "I understand completely. You know where to reach me," I told her. Jean finally cracked a half smile. "You're really a good guy," she said. "For FBI. You're okay for a cop. For LAPD. Then she reached across the table and put her hand on mine. But she quickly took her hand away. "Awkward," she said, and smiled again. "Sorry if I'm being goofy." "You're being human, Jean. That's different, right? I wouldn't apologize for it." "All right. I won't apologize anymore. I have to go, though, before I cry or something incredibly embarrassing like that. You know where to reach me if you need to." Then Jean got up from the table. She turned back before she got to the door. "I'm not off this case, though. I'll be around." Chapter 70. Weird. When I got back to my room that night, an envelope was waiting for me at the front desk. It was from James Truscott. I opened it on my way to my room, and I couldn't stop reading the contents all the way there. Subject: Women on Death Row in California. There were 15 at the moment, and Truscott included a brief write-up on each of them. The first woman was Cynthia Kaufman. In 1986, she and her boyfriend robbed and strangled 4 women. She'd been sentenced in 1989 and was still waiting. Cynthia Kaufman was 42 years old now. At the end of the long note, Truscott said that he planned to visit some of the women in prison. I was welcome to tag along if I thought it might be useful. After I finished reading the pages, I leafed through them a second time.
What was with James Truscott? And why did he want to be my Boswell? I wished he would just leave me alone, but that wasn't going to happen, was it? Chapter 71. The phone in my hotel room woke me at just past 2:30 in the morning. I was having a dream about little Alex and Christine, but I forgot most of it as soon as I heard the first ring. My first coherent thought, James Truscott. But it wasn't him. Around 3 a.m., I was driving through an unfamiliar Hollywood neighborhood looking for the Hillside condo complex. I might have found it sooner in daylight, and if my mind hadn't been racing the whole way there. Mary Smith's game had changed again, and I was struggling to understand it. Why this murder? Why now? Why these two victims? The condo complex, when I finally found it, looked to have been built in the 70s. The units were flat-roofed, three-story structures in dark cedar, with fat columns for legs and open parking underneath. There was also parking on the street, I noticed, and that would offer an intruder privacy. Agent Cross! Alex! I heard from across the lot. I recognized Carl Page's voice from somewhere in the dark. My watch read 3:05. He caught up with me under a streetlight. Over this way, he said. How'd you hear about it? I asked him. Page was the one who had called me in my hotel room. I was still in the office. When the hell do you sleep? I'll sleep when it's over. I followed the young agent through a series of right and left turns to where a square of buildings faced a common garden and pool area. Several residents, many of them in nightclothes, were gathered around one of the front doors. They were craning their necks and whispering among themselves. Page pointed to a third-floor unit where the lights were on behind drawn curtains. Up there, he said. That's where the bodies are. We made our way past the officers on duty and up the front stairs, one of the two ways into the building. Check. Page shorthanded his response to the stickers on the apartment door as we passed inside. Marked with two A's and a B. This was Mary Smith, all right. The stickers always made me think of that clown doll in Poltergeist. Benign on the outside, but completely ominous in context. Child's play turned inside out. The door opened onto a good-sized living room. It was crowded with cardboard moving boxes and haphazardly arranged furniture. In the middle of the room, a man lay dead, face down over a stack of fallen boxes. Several dozen books had spilled onto the sand-colored carpet, several of them streaked with blood. Copies of The Hours and Running with Scissors lay near the body. Philip Washington, Page told me. 35, an investment banker at Merrill Lynch. Well read, obviously.
You too, I guess.
There was no arranging the body this time. No artful tableau. The killer might have been in a hurry given all the neighbors so close by, the lack of sufficient cover. And Philip Washington wasn't the only target. Nearby, another body lay face up on the floor. This was the one I couldn't reconcile. The murder that would dog me. The victim's left temple showed an ugly wound where the bullet had entered, and the face had been repeatedly slashed in Mary Smith's signature style. The flesh around the forehead and eyes was crisscrossed with knife marks, and the cheeks, constricted in a scream, had both been punctured. I stared at the body, just beginning to piece together what had happened and the events that had led up to it. Two questions burned in my mind. Did I have some hand in causing this murder? Should I have seen it coming? Maybe the victim I was staring at had the answer, but L.A. Times writer Arnold Greiner wouldn't be able to help us again on the Mary Smith case. Now Greiner was one of the victims. Part 4. The Blue Suburban. Chapter 72. I had barely begun walking the crime scene when I met up with Maddox Fielding, the LAPD's deputy chief in charge of the detective bureau, and also Jean Galetta's replacement on the case. With his shock of silver hay hair and the same deep brown eyes as Jean's, Fielding looked as though he could have been Jean's father. He struck me as professional and focused from the start. He also seemed to be something of an asshole. "Agent Cross," he said, shaking my hand, "I've heard a lot about your work in D.C. Something in the way he said it didn't exactly sound like a compliment. "This is Special Agent Page," I said. "He's been assisting me while I'm in L.A. Fielding made no response at all, so I pushed on. "What do you make of all this?" I asked him. "I know you're just getting started with the case, but I'm assuming you're up to speed on the priors." The last part wasn't intended as a dig, but it hung in the air as if it were one. Fielding turned down the corners of his mouth and looked at me over the tops of heavy-rimmed bifocals. "This isn't my first serial case. I'm good to go." He took a self-important deep breath. "Now, as to your question, I'm prepared to believe this is Mary Smith's work and not some copycat. I have to wonder if she didn't want Arnold Greiner dead from day one. I believe she did. The questions, of course, would be why and how this motive is related to the previous incidents." Everything he said made some sense, especially that Greiner might have been a target from the start. I turned to Page. "How about you?" I was beginning to wonder what he thought, which he may or may not have recognized as a mark of my growing confidence in him. "Greiner and Washington just moved in," Page said, flipping through a small notebook. "3 days ago, in fact. I know Greiner changed all his info and kept everything unlisted, so Mary would have had to go to at least a little trouble to keep up with him. That's consistent with the stalking aspect, right? And even though Greiner doesn't fit the victim profile, he's been part of Mary Smith's landscape all along. She started with him, and now, I don't know, maybe she's ending with him. Maybe this represents some kind of closure for her. Maybe her story's over." "Doubtful," Fielding said, without even looking at Page. "Too much anger expressed here. Too much rage in Greiner's murder. Have you seen The Grudge?" "Not important. Forget I said it." "What about the Blue Suburban?" I asked. "Any progress there?" As of that afternoon, LAPD hadn't turned up anything promising, which was a little surprising, given the urgency. Fielding pulled out a handkerchief, took off his glasses,